certain wizards. Richard studied her quiet expression, the creases in her face, the sincerity in her eyes. "Are you saying, sister, that if I need to pound my fist against the wall, maybe I should do so?" She gave a slight lift to her eyebrows. "The Creator gave us hunger so we would eat, because eating is necessary. What would be the purpose of a hunger like mine?" She shook her head. "I don't know. For a second time in as many days, the prelate has declined to grant me an audience, but I'm going to try to find some answers. In the meantime, just please don't let the sun set on you in the Hagen Woods." "Is this what you came to tell me, sister?" She looked away and paused, rubbing her forehead with two fingers. She looked uncertain. He had never seen her like this. "Richard, there are things going on that I don't understand, and they are connected to you. Events are not happening as they should." She saw his curious look. "I can't talk about them just yet." She cleared her throat. "Richard, I don't want you to trust every one of the sisters." Richard lifted an eyebrow. "Sister, I trust none of you." That brought a short-lived smile to her face. "For now, that would be best. That was what I wanted to tell you. I'm going to find the answers, but for now, well, let's just say that I know you will do as you must to stay safe." After Sister Verna left, Richard thought about what she had said and about the things Warren had told him. Mostly, he thought about the Stone of Tears. It puzzled him that the magic in the Valley of the Lost would present him with a vision of something he had never seen before and put it around Rachel's neck. The other vision seemed to have been anchored in his longings and fears. Maybe because he missed seeing his friend, Chase, he saw the vision of Rachel, too. She would be with Chase. But why would the vision put around her neck something he had never seen before, which turned out to look like a drawing in a book? Maybe they weren't the same thing. He told himself they couldn't be, but an uneasy feeling inside said otherwise. As much as he missed Chase and Rachel, it was the stone around Rachel's neck that had captured his attention. It was as if Rachel were bringing it to him for Zed, and Zed had been there with him, urging him to take the stone. Pasha's knock at the door brought him out of his brooding. She was wearing a plain, brownish-gray dress with small pink cloth buttons up the front, all the way up to the neck. Though it didn't show the expanse of flesh the green dress had, it was tailored so that it revealed nearly every detail of her shape. The fact that it covered everything only made what it covered all that much more intriguing. The color somehow brought out the softness of her brown hair. Pasha sat cross-legged on the floor, on the blue and yellow carpet in front of the fireplace. She draped her dress carefully over her knees and then looked up. "Here, sit like me in front of me." Richard sat on the floor and folded his legs. She motioned him to come closer until their knees touched. She took his hands and held them lightly as they rested across both of their knees. "Sister Verna didn't do this when I practiced. That was because the Rata Han had to be within the circle of influence of the magic of the palace before we could practice in this way. Until now, when you have practiced touching your Han, it has been alone. Most of the time from now on, I or a sister will use our Han to assist you." She smiled. "It will help you progress faster, Richard."
"All right. What do you want me to do?"
"She told you how to try to reach your Han? How to concentrate on finding that place within yourself?" Richard nodded. "That is what I want you to do. While you search for that place, I will use my Han through the Rata Han to try to guide you." Richard squirmed a little, getting more comfortable. Pasha took back a hand and fanned her face. "This dress seems so warm after wearing the other." She unbuttoned the top five buttons of her dress and then took his hand up again. Richard glanced at the fire to check the logs, so he would know how long it had been when he opened his eyes again. He could never seem to judge the time while he searched for his Han. It always seemed like mere minutes, but it was usually at least an hour. Richard closed his eyes. He brought forth the image of the Sword of Truth on a plain background. As the quiet settled over him, as he sought the peace within, his breathing slowed. He took a long breath and then let himself sink into the calm center. He was aware of Pasha's hands holding his, of her knees touching his, and of her even breathing coming into harmony with his. It felt good to have her holding his hands. He didn't feel isolated the way he had always felt before. He didn't know if she was really using the magic of his collar to go with him, but he felt himself spiraling deeper than he had before. He drifted in the timeless place without thinking, without effort or worry. Whatever his Han was, he didn't see or feel anything he hadn't seen or felt before. Other than feeling more relaxed than before and the comforting feeling of having Pasha with him, it was no different. He was dimly aware of his body starting to feel cramped and of the warmth from the fire. The cold steel of the sword seemed to be a core of ice in the heat. At last he opened his eyes. Pasha opened her eyes with him. Richard glanced to the fire. The logs had been reduced to glowing coals. 2 hours, he judged. A trickle of sweat ran down Pasha's neck. My, but it's warm tonight. She unbuttoned buttons. A lot of buttons. More of her was showing than had shown in the green dress. Richard made himself look back up into her soft eyes. Pasha gave him a small, self-assured smile. I didn't feel anything, Richard said. I didn't sense my Han, although I don't know what it is I'm supposed to sense. I didn't either, and I should have. Strange. She sighed to herself with a puzzled expression. Her face brightened. But it takes practice. Did you feel my Han? Was it any help? No, he admitted. I didn't feel anything. She made a little quirk with her mouth as she frowned. You didn't feel anything of me? He shook his head. Well, close your eyes and try again. It was late, and Richard didn't want to practice anymore. It was tiring, but he decided to do as she wished. He closed his eyes. He concentrated on trying to bring back the sword. Suddenly, he felt Pasha's full lips against his. His eyes opened as she pressed against him. Her eyes were closed, her brow wrinkled. She grasped his face with her hands. Richard gripped her shoulders and pushed her away. She opened her eyes and licked her lips. She smiled coyly. Did you feel that? I felt it. She hooked an arm around his neck. Apparently not enough. Richard gently put a hand against her as she tried to lean in. He didn't want to embarrass her, so he tried to keep his voice pleasant. Pasha, don't. She rubbed her free hand around on his stomach. It's late. No one will be around. If it will make you feel more comfortable, I'll shield the door. You shouldn't worry. I'm not worried. I just don't want to. She looked a bit hurt. You do not think I am pretty enough? Richard didn't want to offend her, and he didn't want to make her angry, but he didn't want to encourage her either. It's not that, Pasha. You're very attractive. It's just that... She unbuttoned another little button. Richard reached out and took a hold of her hand to stop her. He realized the situation was becoming hazardous. She was his teacher. If he angered or humiliated her, things could become dangerously complicated. He had things to do and couldn't afford to turn her antagonistic. She pulled her dress up her legs and put his hand against her thigh. You like this better? She asked in a breathy voice. Richard froze at the firm, sensual feel of her flesh. He remembered what Sister Verna had said, that he would soon find another pair of pretty legs. These were certainly that, and Pasha was leaving precious little to the imagination. He pulled his hand away. Pasha, you don't understand. I think you're a beautiful young woman. Her eyes fixed on his face as she ran her fingers down his beard. I think you're the most handsome man I've ever seen. No, you don't. I love your beard.
Don't ever cut it off. I think a wizard should have a beard.
Richard remembered the time Zed had used additive magic to grow a beard and teach him a lesson, and then had it shaved off, explaining he couldn't make it vanish with magic, because that would take subtractive magic, and wizards didn't have subtractive magic. Subtractive magic was of the underworld. He caught her wrist and pulled her hand away from his face. To Richard, his beard was a symbol of his captivity. It meant he was a prisoner. Prisoners don't shave. That was what he had told Sister Verna, but he didn't think now was the time to explain that to Pasha. She kissed his neck. Somehow he was unable to stop her. Her lips were so soft, and he could hear her insistent breath close to his ear. It felt as if the kiss went all the way through him, down to his toes, something like the feeling he had had when she had put her hands to his Radahan. The tingling numbed his brain. Inside, he groaned. His resistance was being dissolved by her kisses. When he had been held in a collar by Denna, he had had no choice. Not even death could rescue him from whatever Denna wanted. But he still felt shame for what he had done. He was in a collar again, and Pasha was using some sort of magic on him, but he knew that this time he had a choice in the matter. He forced himself to hunch his head and get her lips from him. He gently pushed her back. "Pasha, please." She straightened a little. "What's her name? The girl you love?" Richard didn't want to tell her Kaelin's name. It was his life. It was private. These people were his captors, not his friends. "That's not important. That's not the issue. What does she have that I don't? Is she prettier than me?" "You are a girl," Richard thought, "and she is a woman, but he couldn't say that. You are a pretty candle," he thought, "and Kaelin is the sunrise," but he couldn't say that either. If he spurned Pasha, he would have war on his hands. He had to get out of this without making her feel resentful or rejected. "Pasha, I am honored. I'm flattered. I really am. But you have only known me a day. We've really just met." "Richard, the Creator gives us urges and pleasure from acting on them, so we will come to know His beauty through His creation. There is nothing wrong with this. It is a beautiful thing." "He also gave us a mind to decide what is right and what is wrong." Her chin lifted just a little. "Right and wrong? If she loved you, she would be with you. She wouldn't have let you go. That's what is wrong. She thinks you aren't good enough for her. She must wish to be free of you. If she cared, she would have kept you with her. She's gone. I'm here and I care. I would fight to keep you. Did she fight?" Richard's mouth opened, but no words came through the hurt. He felt as if his will to go on had drained right out of him, leaving nothing but a hollow, dead shell. Pasha reached out and touched his cheek. "You'll see that I care, Richard. I care more than she does. You'll see. It's right if a person cares as I do." Her brow creased in worry. "Unless you think I'm unattractive, is that it? You've seen many women, and you think that in comparison I'm ugly?" Richard cupped a hand to the side of her face. "Pasha, you are ravishing. It's not that." He swallowed the dryness, trying to make his words sound sincere. "Pasha, could you just give me some time? It's simply too soon. Can you understand? Could you really care for a man who would forget his feelings so easily? Could you just give me some time?" She wrapped her arms around him and laid her head against his chest. "I knew yesterday, when you held me so tenderly, that it was another sign that the Creator had sent you to me. I knew then that I would never want another. Since I'll be yours forever, I can wait. We have almost nothing but time. We have all the time you could possibly want. You'll see that I'm the one for you. You just tell me when you're ready, and I'll be yours." Richard sighed as he closed the door behind her. He leaned his back against the door, thinking. He didn't like deceiving Pasha, letting her think that with time he could come to feel differently about her. But he had had to do something. How shallow could Pasha's understanding of people be for her to think that one could win love by invoking lust? He took out the lock of Kaylin's hair, spinning it in his fingers as he watched it. The things Pasha had said about Kaylin not fighting for him made him angry. Pasha could never know the struggles he and Kaylin had been through, the hardships they had had to overcome, the anguish they had suffered together, the battles they had fought together. Pasha probably couldn't conceive of a woman of Kaylin's intelligence, strength, and courage. Kaylin had indeed fought for him. She had more than once selflessly risked her life for him. What could Pasha know of the terrors Kaylin had bravely faced and conquered? Pasha wasn't woman enough to serve Kaylin tea. He stuffed the lock of hair back into his pocket. He forced his thoughts of Kaylin from his mind. He couldn't endure the pain. He had other things to do. Going into the bedroom, he positioned the ash-framed standing mirror and then retrieved his pack from the corner. Richard pulled out the black Mrizwith cape. He threw it around his shoulders and stood inspecting his image in the mirror. It looked like a normal cape. He thought it quite handsome, actually. The cut and length was right. The Mrizwith had been about his size. The heavy fabric was inky black, almost as black as a nightstone that Addie had given him to help him across the pass. Almost as black as the boxes of Ordon. Almost as black as eternal death. But the pleasing cut of the cape was not what intrigued him. Richard moved back against the light brownish wall. He pulled the hood up, cowling it around his face, and drew the cape closed. As he watched his image in the mirror, he concentrated on the wall he was standing against. In the span of a breath, his image vanished. The cape had become the color of the wall he stood against, to such a degree that only if he stared, focusing on the edges of the cape, could he distinguish himself standing against the wall. If he moved, it was only slightly easier to pick out his shape against the wall. Though his face was exposed, somehow the magic of the cape, or possibly the cape's magic along with his own, served to mask it too, to enfold it somehow in the concealing color. This explained why the Mrizwith appeared to be different colors. Richard moved objects behind himself to discover the effect they had. He stood in front of the wall and partly in front of a chair with his red coat draped over it. The cape produced a blotch of red that did a good job of mimicking the color and shape behind. Though it wasn't as flawless as when he stood before a plain wall, it would still be easy to miss him if he stood still. Movement would distort the complicated images as the cape changed to accommodate new conditions, though it still fooled the eye into missing him. But if he stood still, he virtually vanished in front of anything. The effect, at times, could be dizzying to watch. When he stopped concentrating, the cape would return to black. This, he thought as he looked at himself in the mirror standing in a simple black cape, was going to be useful. Chapter 56. As the weeks passed, Richard was constantly busy. He remembered that Kaylin and Zed had told him that there were no wizards with the gift left in the Midlands. Small wonder. They seemed to all be at the Palace of the Prophets. There were well over 100 boys and young men at the palace. From what Richard could discover, a goodly number of the older ones, at least, were from the Midlands, with some even from Dahara. Killing a Mrizwith had earned Richard celebrity status among the younger boys. Two of them, Kip and Hirsch, were the most persistent. They followed him around, begging to hear stories of his adventures. At times, they exhibited the maturity, almost wisdom, of old men. At other times, they, like all boys, seemed interested in nothing more than mischief. The object of this mischief was usually a sister. The boys never seemed to tire of thinking up new tricks to pull on them. Most of the pranks appeared to involve either water, mud, or reptiles. The sisters only occasionally erupted in anger when caught up in the boys' antics, and even then they quickly forgave them. As far as Richard could tell, the boys never earned more than a stern lecture. In the beginning, the young boys thought to number Richard among their targets. Richard had things to do and had no time or patience for it. When the boys learned that Richard was neither shy nor slow with discipline, they quickly moved on to other targets with their buckets of water. The fact that Richard set limits made Kip and Hirsch like him all the more. They seemed starved for older male companionship. Richard rewarded them with adventure stories, or sometimes, when he was going from one place to another and their presence wouldn't impede his progress, he taught them about the woods, tracking, and animals. They coveted staying in Richard's good graces, so when he wanted or needed to be alone, and signaled with a finger or a nod, they vanished. Richard let them be around often when he was with Pasha, since he couldn't do more important tasks then anyway. Frustrated because she couldn't seem to find time alone with him, Pasha was somewhat mollified when Richard got her excluded from the boys' list of targets. She appreciated not having her fine dresses drenched or having to worry about discovering a snake in her shawl. Richard occasionally asked Kip and Hirsch to perform little errands, just to test them. He had plans for their talents. The other young men in collars wanted to show Richard the city. Two, Perry and Isaac, who lived in Gillamy Hall with him, took him into the city and showed him the tavern where many of the guards drank, and he soon after bought swordsman Kevin Andelmere the ale he had promised him. Richard discovered that most of the young men spent their nights away from the palace, staying in various fine inns around the city. It didn't take Richard long to figure out why. They were provided money, the same as he, and they were practiced at spending it. They bought themselves fancy clothes, dressing like princes, and on their overnight stays they picked the finest accommodations. There was no shortage of women wanting to share these accommodations, astonishingly beautiful women. When Perry and Isaac took him to the city, they were always quickly surrounded by attractive women. Richard had never seen women this brazen. Every evening, the two men would each select a woman, sometimes several, and buy them presents, maybe a dress or a bauble, and then depart for their rooms. The two told him that if he didn't want to bother with spending time buying gifts, he could simply go to any of the houses of prostitution, but they assured him that those women were not as young or nearly as pretty as the ones who approached them on the streets. They admitted, though, that they went to prostitutes sometimes when they didn't feel like wasting time being sociable for no more than a simple coupling. When he was spotted with a collar, Richard drew women the same as Perry and Isaac did. Richard was beginning to see in a new light what Sister Verna meant about him soon finding another pair of pretty legs. The other two men thought Richard was mad to turn down all the offers. Sometimes Richard wondered if they might not be right. Richard asked Perry and Isaac if they weren't afraid of a woman's father cracking their skulls. They laughed and said that father sometimes brought their daughters to them. Richard threw his arms up and asked if they weren't concerned about getting some woman they didn't even know pregnant. They explained that if a woman got herself pregnant, the palace would provide for her and the child, even her whole family. When Richard had asked Pasha what was behind such a bizarre convention, she folded her arms across her breasts and presented her back to him while she explained that men had uncontrollable urges, and those urges would be a distraction to learning to use their han. So the sisters encouraged the men to satisfy their needs. That was why she didn't go to the city with him at night. She was restricted from interfering with his needs. She had turned back to him and begged him to come to her with his needs, saying she would see to it that he had no desire to go to other women, or if he did go to the city, to at least allow her to be one of the women he slept with. She told him that she could satisfy him better than any other woman and offered to prove it. Richard was dumbfounded by such talk, to say nothing of the behavior. He told Pasha that he only went to the city to see the sights. Having grown up in the woods, he had never roamed around in a city before. He told her that where he came from, it wasn't right to treat women in such a way. He promised that if he was ever overcome with need, he would come to her first. She was so happy to hear this that she didn't mind when he reminded her that he wasn't ready yet. She had no idea that there were times when he felt so lonely that he was sorely tempted to give in to her. She was unquestionably alluring, and it was sometimes difficult for him to make himself keep her at arm's length. Richard had Pasha show him everything she could of the palace. He had her show him some of the city and take him on a tour of the docks to see the big boats. She said they were called ships because they went to sea. Richard had never seen anything that large afloat. She told him that they brought trade from cities of the old world farther down the coast. Pasha went with him to the sea, and they sat for hours watching the waves or explored the tide pools. Richard was astounded to learn that the sea went up and down with tides all by itself. She assured him that it was not the magic of the palace, but did such a thing everywhere. Richard was spellbound by the ocean. Pasha was content to simply sit with him, but Richard couldn't afford to sit and watch the ocean too often. He had things to do. Pasha wasn't permitted to go with him to the city in the evening, in case he chose to be with a woman. He had to constantly reassure her that that was not why he went out at night. Since it was the truth that he wasn't sleeping with any of the women, he had no difficulty being sincere and convincing her. He did not tell her the truth, however, about what he really was doing. Richard decided that as long as the palace wanted to provide him with money, he was going to allow them to finance their own undoing. He spent the palace's money wherever it would help him. He became a regular at the taverns and inns the palace guards frequented. Whenever he was around, they never paid for a drink. Richard made an effort to learn all their names. At night, he would write down the name of any new guard he had met and everything he could discover about him or any of the other guards. He paid the most attention to those who guarded the prelate's compound, and any other place he discovered he was forbidden access. He stopped by their posts whenever he was at the palace, and inquired idly about their lives, their girlfriends, their wives, their parents, their children, their food, their problems. Richard bought Kevin special expensive chocolates that his girlfriend favored, but which Kevin could ill afford on his wages. The chocolates earned Kevin favors from his girlfriend. Kevin always brightened at Richard's approach, even when he looked tired from the favors. Richard loaned money to any guard who asked, knowing it would never be repaid. When a few made excuses as to why they didn't have the money to pay back, Richard would not hear their reasons, telling them that he understood and that he would feel bad if they were to worry about it. Two of the toughest, who guarded a restricted area on the west side of the palace, would let him buy their ale, but wouldn't warm to him. Richard took it as a challenge. He finally struck on the idea of hiring them the service of four prostitutes, two each, just to get their attention. They wanted to know why. Richard told them how the palace provided him with money and he didn't see why only he should enjoy it. He told them that since they had to stand up all day guarding the palace, he thought it only fair for the palace to pay to put a lady under them when they lay down. The offer was too much for them to resist. They were soon giving him surreptitious winks when he passed. Once they became amenable to his offers, he saw to it that they had reason to give him the winks on a more frequent basis. As Richard knew they would, the two guards began bragging about their romps. When some of the other men found out that Richard had been willing to provide those two with the services of ladies, they pointed out to Richard that it wasn't fair to the others that they should be excluded. Richard conceded that he saw the logic of their argument. He soon discovered that he didn't have the time to handle individual requests, so he struck on an idea. He found a mistress of a brothel open to an inventive business arrangement. He put the establishment on retainer, open only to his friends. He calculated that in this manner he was actually saving the palace money over a piecemeal arrangement. He wanted the men to remember to whom they owed their gratitude, so required they give the mistress the code phrase, "a friend of Richard Cipher," before they would be granted admittance. There were no other restrictions. Richard gave the mistress a healthy raise in the retainer when she complained to him that business was steadier than she had anticipated. Richard soothed his conscience about the morals of what he was doing by reminding himself that he couldn't change what people chose to do, and it might save him from having to kill the guards when the time came. In that light, it made sense. One day, when Pasha was with him and a man gave him a wink, she asked why. He told her it was because he was with the most attractive woman at the palace. She smiled for an hour. Richard accustomed the guards to seeing him in the black cape of the Mrizwith. He kept Pasha happy when he was with her by frequently wearing the red coat she liked best. Sometimes he wore the others, the blue, the dark blue, the brown, or the green. Pasha most liked taking him to the city, but she went for hikes in the surrounding countryside to try to be a part of his interests. Richard learned that the guards were soldiers in the Imperial Order on special detachment to the palace. The Imperial Order ruled all the Old World, but seemed to have a non-intervention policy with the Palace of the Prophets. They never interfered with any sister or any man wearing a Radahan. The guards were stationed at the palace to handle all the people who came to Halsband Island. Every day, people poured over the bridges to come to the palace. Sisters saw petitioners of every want. Some requested charity, some intervention in disputes, and some wished to be guided in the Creator's wisdom. Others came to worship in the courtyard scattered throughout the island. They viewed the place where Sisters of the Light lived as hallowed. Richard learned that the city of Tanimura, vast though it was merely an outpost of the Old World at the fringe of the Empire. Apparently, the Emperor of the Imperial Order had an arrangement with the palace to provide guards, but not law. Richard suspected that the guards were the Emperor's eyes in an area of his empire where he was denied dominion. Richard wondered what the Emperor received in return for this arrangement. Richard also learned that in at least one of the restricted areas, the sisters had a special guest who never came out, but he was unable to discover any more. Richard began testing the guards' loyalty to him with simple, innocuous requests. He told Kevin that he wanted a special rose for Pasha that grew only in the prelate's compound. Richard made a point of parading Pasha, wearing the yellow rose, past Kevin. Kevin smiled with pride. At other restricted areas, Richard used the flower excuse or said that he wanted to get a view of the sea from atop a particular wall. He made sure to remain in sight at all times to reassure the guards and dull their sense of caution. It wasn't long before he had all the guards accustomed to his forays. After a time, he was coming and going almost as he pleased. He was their friend, a trusted and valuable friend. Since he was collecting so many rare flowers from the restricted areas, he used them to an advantage. He presented them to the sisters who practiced with him. They were puzzled as to why he would give them flowers from restricted areas. He explained that he considered the sisters who trained him to be special, and he therefore didn't want them to have just any flowers, but those that were special and artfully obtained. Besides making them blush, this explanation also disarmed an otherwise inevitable suspicion if he frequented restricted areas. Though, as near as Richard could tell, there were close to 200 sisters, only 6 worked with him. Sisters Tovi and Cecilia were older, and as kind as doting grandmothers. Tovi always brought cookies or some other treat to their sessions. Cecilia insisted on combing his hair back off his forehead with her fingers and planting a kiss there before she left. Both blushed furiously when he gave them rare flowers. Richard had difficulty thinking of either as potential enemies. The first time Sister Marissa showed up at his door, Richard almost swallowed his tongue. Her dark hair and the way she filled her red dress made him stumble over his words like a fool. Sister Nikki, who never wore any color but black, had the same effect on him. When Sister Nikki locked her blue eyes on his, he had trouble remembering how to breathe. Sisters Marissa and Nikki were older than Pasha, his age, or maybe at most a couple of years older. They carried themselves with confidence and slow grace. Though Marissa was dark and Nikki blonde, they seemed to be cut from the same rare cloth. The power of their Han radiated from each, making them almost seem to glow. Richard sometimes thought he could almost hear the air crackle around them. Neither walked, both glided, like swans, serene and cool. Yet he was sure either could smelt iron ore with their placid glances. Neither ever grinned. They bestowed small, subdued smiles. And only while looking him in the eye, Richard could feel his heart thumping faster when they did. Once, he offered Sister Nikki one of his rare flowers from a restricted area. His explanation of where it had come from and the story of why he was giving it to her flew right out of his head. She took the white rose gingerly between a finger and thumb, as if it might soil her hand, and while her gaze held his, she gave him one of her subdued smiles and said in an indifferent tone, "Why, thank you, Richard." What Pasha had told him about boys bringing sisters frogs came to his mind. He never gave either Sister Nikki or Marissa a flower again. Anything less than priceless jewels seemed an insult. Neither ever offered to sit on the floor for their sessions. In fact, the very idea of Sisters Marissa or Nikki sitting on the floor seemed ludicrous to him. The older sisters, Tovi and Cecilia, sat on the floor, the same as Pasha, and it seemed perfectly natural. Sisters Marissa and Nikki sat in chairs and held his hands across a small table. It somehow seemed an erotic experience. It made him sweat. They both spoke with a quiet economy of words that added an air of nobility to their bearing. While neither ever made a clear offer, they managed to somehow leave no doubt in Richard's mind that they were available to spend the night with him. Richard could never pin down anything specific in what they said to confirm the impression, but he had no doubt. Their oblique words left him room to feign missing their intent, and neither ever deigned to clarify what she had said. He prayed that they would never make the offer any more explicit, because if they did, he knew he would have to bite his tongue in half to keep from saying yes. Both brought to mind what Pasha had told him about men having uncontrollable urges. He had never been around anyone who could make him stammer and fumble, and in general make himself appear a fool as those two did. Sisters Marissa and Nikki were the embodiment of pure, unadulterated lust. When Pasha found out that Sisters Marissa and Nikki were two of his teachers, she gave a small shrug and said they were very talented sisters, and she was sure they would help him reach his Han. But her cheeks broke out in red blotches. When Perry and Isaac found out about Sisters Marissa and Nikki, they both nearly succumbed to apoplexy. They said they would give up all the women in the city forever just to have one night with either. They said that if Richard was ever offered the opportunity, he had to take it and tell them every detail. Richard assured them that women the likes of those two would never be interested in a woods guide like him. He dared not say out loud that the offer had been made. The fifth sister, Armina, was older, a mature woman who was pleasant enough, but all business. When he had no more luck finding his Han with her than any of the others, she told him that it would come with time and not to feel disappointed, but perhaps he should try to put more effort into it. Over time, she warmed to him and smiled more. She was surprised and flattered by the special flowers. She blushed at her own blushes. Richard liked her straightforward personality. The last sister, Liliana, was Richard's favorite. Her easy smile was disarming, her plain, bony look somehow alluring because of her open, friendly nature. She treated Richard like a confidant. Richard felt relaxed with her, sometimes spending more time than he could afford, talking with her late into the night simply because he enjoyed her company. Though he had no friends among his captors, she came closer than any. When Richard gave her the special flower, she hooked some of her brown hair behind an ear and leaned in. Her eyes were wide with mischief, wanting to know how he had gotten past the guards. She giggled when he told her the story he invented of sneaking behind their backs. She stuck each rose proudly through a buttonhole and wore it until it wilted, or he gave her another. When she touched him in a friendly way, it somehow seemed the natural thing to do. He found himself laying a hand on her arm in the same manner when he told her funny stories about when he had been a guide. They roared with laughter together, holding their ribs and getting tears. Sister Liliana told him how she had grown up on a farm and loved the country. Several times Richard invited her on a picnic out in the hills. She was comfortable and happy in the countryside. She didn't care if she got her dress dirty. Richard couldn't imagine either Sister Marissa or Nikki setting a foot to dirt, but Sister Liliana would flop right down on the ground with him. She never made an offer to sleep with him. That in itself put him at ease. She never displayed any pretense. She seemed to genuinely enjoy her time with him. When he opened his eyes after a session with her and admitted he felt no Han, she would squeeze his hands and tell him that it was all right, and that she would try harder the next time to help him. Richard found himself telling her things he told none of the others. When he confided how much he wanted the Radahan off, she put a hand to his arm as she gave him a wink and told him that she would see to it that he had his wish, that when the time came, she would do it herself. She said she could understand his feelings, and for him to have faith. She promised that if one day he was at the end of his tolerance and he truly could stand it no longer, she would help him. She would remove the collar. But she wanted him to know that she had faith in him and wanted him to put in his best effort to learn to control his Han before she even considered it. She said that other young men tried to forget their color by betting every woman willing. She told him that she could understand urges, but she hoped that if he chose to sleep with a woman, it would be because he liked her and not because he was trying to forget the color. She told him not to go to the prostitutes because they were dirty and he would catch something. Richard told her that he was in love with someone and didn't want to be unfaithful to her. She grinned and clapped him on the back and said she was proud of him. Richard didn't tell her that Kaelin had sent him away, but he wanted to. He knew that someday, if he could stand it no longer, he could tell Liliana, and she would listen and understand. Because he was so comfortable around her, he felt that if anyone could help him find his Han, it would be her. He hoped it would be her. Richard had had only a brother and didn't know what it would be like to have a sister, but he imagined that if he did have one, she would be like Liliana. The name Sister Liliana had a different meaning to him than was intended. She seemed his soulmate. Still, he couldn't let himself open up completely to her. The sisters were his captors, not his friends. They were the enemy for now. But he knew that when the time came, Liliana would side with him. Richard's lessons with the six sisters took up at most 2 hours a day, a waste of 2 hours as far as he was concerned. He was no closer to touching his Han than he had been the first time Sister Verna had him try. When Richard could manage to be alone, he explored the land around the palace and found the limits of his invisible chain. When he reached the farthest distance the collar would allow him to go, it felt like trying to walk through a 10-foot-thick wall of mud layered over solid rock. It was frustrating to be able to see beyond, without obstruction, yet not be able to continue walking. It happened, as near as he could tell, about the same distance from the palace in any direction. It was a good number of miles, but once he found the limit, his world began to feel very small indeed. The day he found his boundary, the limits of his prison, he went to the Hagen Woods and killed Amrizwith. His only true solace was Gratch. Richard spent most nights with the Gar. He wrestled with his furry friend, ate with him, and slept with him. Richard hunted food for Gratch, but the Gar was learning to hunt on his own. Richard was relieved to learn that. He didn't have the time to be with him every night. Hungry or not, Gratch was always distraught when Richard missed a night. Richard was worried that Pasha would know where he went all the time by his collar, but quite by accident he discovered something else his Mrizrith cape did. It masked from Pasha his whereabouts. When he wore the cape, she couldn't find him by his Radahan, by his Han. She was puzzled by his blanking out from her sense of where he was, but didn't seem too concerned, offering that perhaps it had an explanation that she would come to figure out one day. She seemed to think it was a deficiency on her part. Richard never offered her the solution. He realized that this was the reason none with the gift ever knew Amrizwith was coming. Richard wondered why he had been able to see the beast in his mind. Maybe it was as Sister Verna said, that he was using his Han. But sisters and wizards knew how to use their Han and couldn't detect the Mrizwith. Richard had an easier time when he could go where he pleased, and knew Pasha would not know where he was, It saved thinking up explanations. He worried that if she ever discovered the reason, she would destroy his cape, so he hid a second for that contingency. Gratch seemed to be bigger every time Richard saw him. By the end of Richard's first month at the palace, the Gar was a head taller than Richard and significantly stronger. When they wrestled, Gratch learned to be careful not to hurt him. Richard also spent some of his time with Warren, getting him used to going outside. At first, he took Warren out into the courtyards at night. Warren told him that the size of the sky and landscape frightened him, so Richard reasoned that night would show him less of the landscape, at least to start. Warren said that the sisters had had him down in the vaults for so long that he thought he just became used to being closed in, but he was tired of it. Richard felt sorry for him and wanted to help him. He really liked Warren. He was about as smart as anyone Richard had ever met. There didn't seem to be anything that Warren didn't know at least a little about. Warren was nervous about being away from the safety of the palace, but was reassured by Richard's presence and the way Richard never ridiculed his fears. Richard was always considerate, never taking Warren farther than he felt comfortable. Richard told him that it was just like after you were injured and had been laid up for a while. It took time to stretch the old muscles. After a few weeks of their nighttime forays, Richard started taking Warren out in the daylight. First, just up onto the walls to look at the vastness of the sky and ocean. Warren was always close to the stairway that led back down into the palace, so he was reassured by having an escape route close by if he felt he had to go back inside. A few times he did, and Richard always went with him and talked about other things to take his mind away from the uncomfortable feeling. Richard had Warren bring a book outside with him so he could be distracted by reading. Letting Warren forget about the size of the sky helped. On a bright sunny day, after Warren had become comfortable out of doors, Richard decided to try taking him out into the hills. Warren was a bit giddy at first, but as they sat on a rock high in the hills overlooking the countryside and the city, Warren said that he felt as if he had mastered his fear. He said that he still felt uncomfortable, but he felt the fear was under control. He grinned at the vast landscape spread out below, enjoying the sight that for so long his fears denied him. Richard told him that he was happy that he was the one to have been able to guide him out of his molehole. Warren laughed. Warren said he needed adventure in his life, and this felt like the beginning. As far as Warren's search for information was going, he had been able to find out precious little. He had so far found only a few references in old books that talked about the Valley of the Lost and the Baka Ban Mana, but what he found was intriguing. The information made reference to the power the wizards had given the Baka Ban Mana in return for taking their land, so that they could someday have their land restored. It said that when the completing link was joined with this power invested in their spirit woman, the towers would fall. Richard thought about Duchailu, saying that he was the Kaharan, and that they were now husband and wife. That was a linking of sorts. He wondered if over the intervening time the meaning of this joining could have been taken to mean marriage instead of its original intent. As they sat watching the vast landscape, Warren said, "The prelate has been reading prophecies and histories that talk about the pebble in the pond." Richard's ears perked up. He remembered Kaelin singing him a song about Skreelings that mentioned the pebble in the pond. Warren hadn't studied those prophecies before and hadn't been able to piece together their importance as of yet. "Do you know what the wizard's second rule is?" Richard asked. "Second rule? Wizards have rules? What's the first?" Richard looked over. "Do you remember that night Jedediah broke his leg? And I told you that you had carpet ash on you, and you tried to brush it off? I was using the wizard's first rule." Warren frowned. "You think on it, Warren, and let me know what you figure out. In the meantime, it's important that you speed up the search for the information I asked you about." "Well, it will be a little easier now that Sister Becky is sick every morning and won't be looking over my shoulder. She's pregnant," he said in answer to Richard's questioning frown. "Do many of the sisters have children?" "Sure," Warren said. "What with all the young wizards around who can no longer go to the city, the sisters help out with their needs so they can study." Richard gave Warren a suspicious look. Is Sister Becky's child yours? Warren blushed furiously. No! He kept his eyes to the city. I'm waiting for the one I love. Pasha, Richard said. Warren nodded. Richard looked down at the Palace of the Prophets and the city that surrounded it. Needs. Warren, do all the children of men with the gift inherit it? Oh, no. It's said that many thousands of years ago, before the old and new world were separated, many had the gift. But over time, those in power methodically killed off young ones with the gift, so they would have no one to threaten their rule. They also withheld the required teaching. It used to be that fathers taught their sons, but as fewer were born with the gift, and it skipped more and more generations, those who knew the way jealously guarded their knowledge. That's the reason the Palace of the Prophets was created, to help those with the gift who had no teacher. As time went on, the gift was bred out of the race of man, the way you breed a trait out of an animal. This gave the wizards who held power less and less opposition all the time. Now that the trait is so bred out, one born with a gift is exceedingly rare. Maybe only one child in 1,000 fathered by a wizard is born with a gift. We're a dying breed. Richard looked to the city again, then to the palace. His eyes locked on the palace. Richard slowly rose to his feet. They're not seeing to our needs, he whispered. They're using us as breeding stock. Warren stood, his brow wrinkled. What? They're using the palace, the young men at the palace, to breed wizards. Warren's brow furrowed deeper. Why? Richard's jaw muscles flexed. I don't know, but I intend to find out. Good, Warren said with a grin. I need an adventure. Richard gave him a cold look. Do you know what adventure is, Warren? Warren nodded, the smile still on his face. An exciting experience. Adventure is being scared to death and not knowing if you will live or die, or if the ones you love will live or die. Adventure is being in trouble you don't know how to get out of. Warren fumbled with the braiding on his sleeve. I never thought about it like that. Well, you think on it, Richard said, because I'm about to start an adventure. What are you going to do? The less you know, the less adventure you'll have to worry about. You just find out the things I need to know. If the veil is torn, we're all going to have a never-ending adventure. Well, Warren said with a twinkle in his eye, I found out at least one thing of help then. The Stone of Tears? Warren nodded with a grin. I found out there is no way you could have seen it. It's locked behind the veil. In a way, it's part of the veil. Are you sure? Are you sure I couldn't have seen it? Positive. The Stone of Tears is the seal that keeps the Nameless One locked in his prison of the dead in the underworld. He can rule the souls of the dead there with him, but he cannot come to this world. The Stone of Tears seals him there. Good, Richard said with a relieved sigh. That's great, Warren. Good work. He gently gripped Warren's robe and pulled him closer. You're sure? There's no way the Stone of Tears could be in this world? Warren confidently shook his head. None. It's impossible. The only way for the Stone of Tears to be in this world would be for it to come through the gateway. Richard felt his flesh beginning to tingle. Gateway? What's the gateway? Well, the gateway is what the name implies, a passage. In this case, a passage between the world of the living and the world of the dead. It's magic of both worlds, a passage constructed of magic. The gateway can only be opened with both additive and subtractive magic. The Nameless One has only subtractive, since he is in the underworld, so he can't open the gateway. The same way someone in this world could not open it, because we have only additive magic. Bumps were rising on Richard's arms. But someone in this world, someone with both forms of magic, could open the gateway? Well, sure, Warren stammered. If they had the gateway. But it has been lost for over 3,000 years. It's gone. He gave Richard a self-assured smile. We're safe. Richard wasn't smiling. He grabbed Warren's robes in both hands and yanked his face close. Warren, tell me the gateway isn't called the Magic of Ordon. Tell me the gateway isn't the Three Boxes of Ordon. Warren's eyes slowly expanded to the size of gold pieces. Where did you hear that name for it? he whispered in a disquieted tone. I'm the only one in the palace besides the prelate and two other sisters who are permitted to read the book that called the gateway by its ancient name. Richard gritted his teeth. What happens if one of the boxes is opened?
They can't be opened, Warren insisted.
They can't. I told you, it takes both kinds of magic, additive and subtractive, to open a box.
Richard shook him. What happens?
His eyes still wide, Warren swallowed.
Then the gateway between the worlds is opened. The veil is breached. The seal is off the nameless one.
And the Stone of Tears would be in this world?
Warren nodded as Richard tightened his grip on the robes. And if the box were to be closed, that would close the gateway, seal the breach?
No. Yes. But it can only be closed by one with the gift. It takes the touch of magic to close the gateway. But if one with the gift closes the box, the gateway, then it ruptures the balance, because he has only additive magic, and the nameless one escapes the underworld. More correctly, this world would be swallowed into the world of the dead.
Then how can the box be closed to keep the world separated?
The same way the gateway is opened, with both additive and subtractive magic.
And what about the Stone of Tears?
I don't know. I would have to study.
Then you better study fast.
Please,
Warren whined.
You don't mean that you know where the boxes are? You haven't found them, have you?
Found them? The last time I saw the boxes, one was opened, about to suck my bastard father into the underworld.
Warren fainted. Chapter 57. Under the impotent rays of the late day sun, an old woman was spreading wood ash on the ice covering the vast expanse of stairs. Kaelin walked past, relieved that the old woman didn't look up to see that the person in the heavy clothes, white fur mantle, and carrying a pack and bow was the Mother Confessor returned to Adendrill. She was in no mood for starting a celebration tonight. She was exhausted. Already, before coming home to the palace, she had climbed up to the wizard's keep on the mountainside, but the keep was stone cold and dark as death. The shields were in place, though a confessor could enter, but no one was inside. Zed was not there. The keep sat now, as the last time she had seen it so many months ago, when she had left to find the missing great wizard. She had found him, and helped stop the threat from Darkenrall, but now she needed the great wizard again. Since leaving the Galleon army nearly a month before, she had been struggling to reach Adendrill and Zed. Storms had raged for days at a time. Passes had been rendered impassable by the weather and snow, forcing them to backtrack and find alternate routes. It had been a frustrating and tiring journey, but the despair at reaching her goal and not finding Zed was withering. Kaelin had made her way through the side streets, avoiding King's Row. The palaces on King's Row housed dignitaries, staffs, and guards of the lands that were represented in Adendrill. The kings and queens and rulers of those lands stayed in their palaces when they came to address the council. The palaces were a matter of pride for each land, and each was magnificent, although none could begin to compare to the Confessor's Palace. Kaelin had avoided King's Row because she would be recognized there, and she didn't want to be recognized right now. She wanted only to find Zed and, failing that, speak to the council, so she headed toward the service area to the side near the kitchens. Chandelin was out in the forest. He didn't want to come into Adendrill. The size of the city and the multitudes of people made him uneasy, though he denied it, and claimed only to be more comfortable sleeping outside. Kaelin couldn't blame him. After being alone in the mountains for so long, she, too, was uneasy going into the city, even though she had grown up in this place and knew its streets and majestic buildings as well as Chandelin knew the plains around the Mud People village. The people everywhere made her feel closed in as never before. Chandelin wanted to go home to his people, now that she was delivered safely to Adendrill. She could understand his desire to be off, but asked him to rest the night and say goodbye to her in the morning. She had told Orsk to spend the night with Chandelin. His presence was wearing, his one eye following her everywhere, his jumping to help her with everything, his constantly standing ready to do her bidding at the slightest indication. It was like having a dog continually at heel. She needed a night away from that. Chandelin seemed to understand. She didn't know what she was going to do about Orsk. A stifling blast of warm air hit her as she went in through the kitchen entrance. At the sound of the door, a thin woman in a sparkling white apron spun to her.
"What are you doing in here? Get out, you beggar!"
As the woman lifted her wooden spoon in a threatening manner, Kaylin pushed back the hood of her mantle. The woman gasped. Kaylin smiled. "Mistress Sanderholt, I'm so pleased to see you again."
"Mother Confessor!"
The woman fell to her knees, clasping her hands together.
"Oh, Mother Confessor, forgive me. I didn't recognize you. Oh, good spirits be praised. Is it really you?"
Kaylin pulled the wiry woman to her feet. "I've missed you so, Mistress Sanderholt." Kaylin held out her arms. "Give me a hug." Mistress Sanderholt fell into Kaylin's arms.
"Oh, child, it's so good to see you."
She pushed away, tears running down her face.
"We didn't know what had become of you. We were so worried. I thought I might never see you again."
"It has been a long and difficult time. I can't tell you how good it is to see your face again." Mistress Sanderholt started pulling Kaylin toward a side table.
"Come, you need a bowl of soup. I have some on now, if those feather brains who do what scarcely passes for cooking haven't ruined it with too much pepper."
The welter of cooks and help caught the words and kept their heads down, applying their attention to their tasks. The sounds of whisks and spoons on bowls stepped up. Men picked up sacks and hurried away. Brushes worked at pots with greater zeal. Butter hissed in hot pans, and bread in ovens and meat on spits suddenly needed checking.
"I don't have time right now, Mr. Sanderholt." "But I have things I must tell you, important things."
"I know, I have things to tell you too, but right now I must see the council. It's urgent. I've been traveling a long time and I'm exhausted, but I must see the council before I rest. We will talk tomorrow."
Mistress Sanderholt couldn't resist another hug. "Of course, child. Rest well. We will talk tomorrow."
Kaylin took the shortest route, through the immense hall used for important ceremonies and celebrations. Fires in the large, magnificent fireplaces set around the room between fluted columns sent shadows of herself spiraling around her as she crossed the green slate floor. The room was empty now, allowing her footsteps to echo overhead from the intricate Lierne vaulting with its wave-like sweeping ribs. Her father used to set thousands of walnuts and acorns, representing troops, all over the floor of this room to teach her battle tactics. She turned down the hall at the far end, toward the corridor, to the council chambers. In the confessor's private gallery, groups of four glossy black marble columns to each side supported a progression of polychrome vaults. At the end, before the council chambers, was a round, two-story-high pantheon dedicated to the memory of heroines, the founding mother confessors. Their portraits, in frescoes, between the seven massive pillars ranging to the skylight, were twice life-size. Kaylin always felt like a pretender to the post in the presence of the seven stern faces that overlooked the room. She felt they were saying, "And who are you, Kaylin Amnell, to think you could be the mother confessor?" Knowing the histories of those heroines only made her feel all the more inadequate. Grabbing both brass levers, she threw the tall mahogany doors open and marched into the council chambers. A huge dome capped the enormous room. At the far end, the main vault was decorated with an ornate fresco celebrating the glory of Magda Cirrus, the first mother confessor. Her fingers were touching the back of the hand of her wizard, Merit, who had laid down his life to protect her. Together now, for all time in the colorful fresco, the two oversaw the mother confessors who followed and sat in the first chair and their wizards. Between the colossal gold capitals of the columns thrusting up around the room were sinuous, polished mahogany railings at the edge of balconies that overlooked the elegant chamber. The arched openings set at intervals around the room and leading up to the balconies were decorated with sculpted stuccos of heroic scenes. Beyond were windows looking out over the courtyards. Round windows around the lower edge of the dome also let light into the glistening chamber. At the far end was the semicircular dais where the counselors sat behind an elaborate curved desk. the opulent first chair in the center, was the tallest. A clump of men were gathered around the first chair. By the numbers, Kaelin judged about half the council to be present. As she strode across long swaths of sunlight on the patterned marble floor, the heads began to follow her progress. Someone was sitting in the first chair. Although not enforced in recent times, it was a capital offense for a counselor to take the first chair, as it was considered tantamount to a declaration of revolution. The conversation hushed as she approached. It was High Prince Fyron of Kelton sitting in the chair. His feet were up on the desk, and he didn't take them down as he watched her draw near. His eyes were on her, but he was listening to a man with smoothed down dark hair and beard, streaked with a touch of gray, leaning over whispering to him. The man's hands were in the opposite sleeves of his plain robes. Strange, she thought, for an advisor to be dressed so, like a wizard. Prince Fyron lifted his eyebrows in delight.
Mother Confessor!
With deliberate care, he took his polished boots down and came to his feet. He put his hands to the desk and leaned over, looking down.
So good to see you!
Before, Kaelin had always had a wizard. Now, she had none. No protection. She could not afford to appear timid or vulnerable. She glared up at Prince Fyron. If I ever again catch you in the chair of the Mother Confessor, I will kill you. He straightened with a smirk.
You would use your power on a counselor?
I will slit your throat with my knife if I have to. The man in the plain robes watched her with unmoving dark eyes. The other counselors blanched. Prince Fyron pulled his dark blue coat open and rested a hand on his hip.
Mother Confessor, I meant no offense. You have been gone for a long time. We all thought you were dead. There has been no confessor in the palace for... what?
He looked to a few of the other men.
4, 5, 6 months?
Hands still on his hip, he held his other out and gave a bow.
I meant no offense, Mother Confessor. Your chair is returned to you, of course.
Kaelin eyed the remaining men. It is late. The council will meet in full session first thing in the morning. Every counselor will be present. The Midlands is at war. Prince Fyron lifted an eyebrow.
War? On whose authority? We have not discussed such a grave matter.
Kaelin swept her gaze over the counselors, letting it finally settle on Prince Fyron. On my authority as the Mother Confessor. Whispering broke out among the men. Prince Fyron never let his eyes leave hers. When she glowered at the men who were whispering, it sputtered.